The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
As I was leaving home this morning, the last thing my wife said to me was, don't be surprised if there's very few people at IMC today. because many people are celebrating Earth Day today. I guess Earth Day is on the 22nd of April, but this is the closest Sunday. And so it's nice that we're celebrating Earth Day. And it's very meaningful to me, the photograph we have of the Earth from the moon in space, this wonderful jewel, beautiful jewel, blue jewel, kind of hang there in space, this vast, vast emptiness. And how is it that we have this little jewel? It's like a miracle, right? That there's this little dot from far enough away, it's not even a dot. This teeny little Earth that so beautiful. Historically, Buddhism has often used the moon as a very important symbol. And in a way, back in ancient India, they didn't even know the world was round. They thought basically it was flat. But the moon, they could see in the sky, and the full moon in particular, represented the awakened mind, the liberated mind, the purified mind, that full, bright, the full brightness of the full moon is like the full brightness of liberated mind. There are beautiful, down through the history of Buddhism, there's beautiful poems, poetry, imagery used that includes the full moon. And when you get to Japan, where they brought together the images of the moon and the Buddhist teachings on impermanence, there's a very deep appreciation of how fleeting so much of life is and how quickly things change, which is a very important insight in Buddhism. It's part of one of the liberating insights in Buddhism is the fleeting nature of our lives, life, experience. And so they brought the image of the moon, full moon, together with this the idea of fleetingness with that of the image of something that's very temporary is the morning dew. And you wake up and the dew is there, but pretty quickly the sun dries it up and it goes away. It's very temporary. And so the image was used in Japanese poetry was that of the moon in the dewdrop. The idea that even something as ephemeral as a dewdrop, you can see right there also, you could see awakening, you could find awakening. Somehow there's a deep respect, deep appreciation, not only for the awakened mind, but how the awakened mind is found in the smallest little kind of seemingly insignificant aspects of nature, found in nature. Similar kind of teachings abound in Buddhism, where people say that we hear the Buddha's teachings in the wind and the rustling of the leaves and the gurgle of the creeks and the brooks. And that's where we find the Buddha's teachings. So the idea of the moon and the dewdrop. But now we have this image of the Earth from space. We can step back and see, just like we can see the moon in the sky, from the moon we can see the Earth in the sky in space. And there's a whole other side to Buddhism that is very different from the idea of the moon and the dewdrop, that I think is nicely expressed in the expression the earth in a teardrop. The earth in a teardrop. And the teardrop's pretty ephemeral as well, but a teardrop from our compassion and seeing this world, a way of seeing this world that not only is it a beautiful jewel, but there's been rivers of blood, and take all the blood that's been spilled in the 20th century, and there's rivers and rivers of blood. They say something like 100 million people died in wars in the 20th century, and it's a million people a year. It's quite something. And then we have the environmental problems that not new to the planet, but we're much more conscious of it now. And it's quite something to watch it happen, and it kind of breaks the heart, teardrop the earth in a teardrop. So we have the juxtaposition of the moon in a dewdrop. You know, this wonderful awakening that's seen in the world, this beautiful nature, natural world of ours. And then also a whole other perspective on this world of ours, the earth in a teardrop. So how do we kind of meet these two? How do we bring these two together? If we see the tear not as a problem exactly, but as a really an expression of compassion, then the two are meant to be wedded together. The wisdom that sees the moon with the compassion that sees life as it actually is. So where do these two meet? And in a sense, the idea of the moon is a little bit idealistic also, something high up in the sky, and it's a little bit idealistic, but can be that way. Certainly there are Buddhists who succumb to idealism. But if you're too much in the world, for many people being in the world, you know, there's an expression, you know, to be a worldly person often is not a very, sometimes it's a nice thing, someone has street smarts and understands how the world works. But often a worldly person, someone who's also caught up in the world of greed, hate, delusion, you know, everything, and doesn't know anything else. So how do we bring these two together? And the a third image, which is very meaningful for me, you know, and a mind often operates on images we hold, symbolic images, is that of the Buddha sitting on the ground under a tree. And I think it's a very powerful image, at least for me. Powerful because it represents someone who's found fulfillment, found a deep peace, abiding peace and happiness in the simplicity of nature, or in the simplicity of being, where doesn't need to have a lot of money, doesn't need to have a big house, doesn't need to have the latest car, the latest, you know, MP3 player. You know, so many things that people are driven to have and to want. Doesn't need to have a, you know, beautiful, fulfilling, intimate relationship. You know, so many things that, you know, drive people. Some of the things are nice in themselves, can be nice in themselves, but there can be, you know, two primary problems with the life of pursuing much of what people pursue in this worldly life. One is that it's so easy to get caught up in greed and the sorrow around these things. And not a few people suffer a lot because of being driven by desire, being driven by greed, or being in that drivenness being devastated in a variety of ways when things don't turn out the way that they want to turn out. And so the problem is not the things of the world, but rather it's the way we're caught up in them. And the second problem, of course, we know, is the tragedy of the commons, as it's called in the ecology movement. And that is that the tragedy of the commons is that when the commons, like in ancient America, in early America, they had these commons, the village commons that everyone shared. And as long as only, you know, a few people shared the village commons thrived. But when you have too many people using the same resource, it exhausts it. So we have, you know, part of our commons is the air we breathe. And the first automobile was great. No problem for the common, for the air we breathe, you know, just the air could handle it. But when you get, you know, the first 100 cars was okay, first 1,000, first 10,000, first 1,000,000 cars, you're fine. But at some point, there was a tipping point reached. And the tragedy of the commons is that tipping point where the benefit, the harm it's caused outweighs the benefit, or there's, you know, reaches a point of harm. The commons can't handle it all. So, you know, the problem, this life of consumption that people are caught up in. And so the image of a Buddha is someone who's found very deep peace and fulfillment and happiness without consuming, without taking all these things on that people want to have for themselves. And I think it's a very powerful image. And it's a very, I think, challenging image because hopefully, you know, it challenges our basic assumptions about what we need, what's important for us. And we can grapple with that and, you know, question deeper. It's also an image not only of someone who can be fulfilled with very little, kind of simplicity of being, just sitting there in nature, in a tree, under a tree, but it's also someone who can sit there in nature without a locked house, and feel safe. And that's a very powerful image as well. Someone who could sit that way, feeling quite safe, undefended, open, present. And what does it take? And in some ways, those two are related, because it's been pointed out that the more things that people have, the more they're threatened by thieves and all kinds of things. And so there's more inclination to lock the house. I know people for whom basically live a fairly relatively poor life, happy, very happy life, but poor life. And they're the ones I know who never lock their houses, even when they're sleeping. And even right in Palo Alto. Can you imagine that? Those of you who live in Palo Alto? And so this wonderful image, I think, is a powerful image. It's an image, you know, in nature. And you find that the Buddha, and down through the history of Buddhism, a great emphasis of practicing in nature. In fact, the Buddha said that as long as there are monastics who delight living in the forest at the foot of trees, the way of the awakened ones will not decline. Isn't that neat? And so, you know, we have one big tree here on our property. And maybe because it's a big redwood, we could say we're sitting at the foot of it. But we have last year we had a monk, a wonderful American monk named Ajahn Chandoko, who I think will come by again within the next month. And he has he mostly lives in New Zealand, but he has a small 5-acre plot of land in Boulder Creek in the woods there that has no buildings on it. I think maybe he has a platform to sleep on. He comes but once a year for a month or so. And he just lives there in the woods. And it's a lifestyle that still exists for some people. Beautiful lifestyle, I think. Not only is it a lifestyle that consumes very little, doesn't, you know, a small footprint, right? But also it's a lifestyle that demonstrates a level of happiness, well-being, peace, contentment that requires so little. It just needs to be in nature. And I think hopefully all of you have some sense of having been in nature, gone for a hike, backpacking, been at the beach. And it's so rejuvenating, it's so nourishing. And in that wonderful nourishment, feeling really rich, feeling really kind of filled, feeling so content and satisfied. So little is needed in that kind of environment. And it's so easy sometimes to not be in touch with nature and then be caught up in the social messages that somehow are epidemic in our society about wanting, having, getting, defending, being angry, you know, all the stuff about our social life. And so to have the example of people who live in nature, I think, for me, is inspiring to think of that, and feeds me as well, just their example, knowing them. And in fact, if you become a Buddhist monastic, one of the first instructions you're supposed to get, this is what the Buddha said, those monks who are new to the monastic life should be encouraged in this way. Come, friends, be forest dwellers. Resort to remote lodgings in the forest and woodlands. Isn't that nice? So many of you won't be monastics now. But to be in the woods. And there is a strong forest tradition in Buddhism, in Thailand and other countries. And what really inspires me also, not only is their example, but also how some of these forest monks have become the leaders in the environmental movement in Thailand, and trying to protect the very forests that they live in, that, that, you know, their whole lifestyle depends on. And one of the beautiful examples is, there's many examples, but there's one is people in Thailand have a very deep reverential attitude towards monasticism. It's very sacred, the monastic life. And so monks have gone and ordained the trees and wrap Buddhist robes around them. And the loggers come and they don't dare, you know, cut down that tree. So, and in some places, it's kind of sad in Thailand, there's the forest monks, the monasteries, which are the only forests left in some areas. You know, that's where they, you know, they come, these areas, everything else has been cut down and clear cut and farmed or whatever. And somehow the forest monks preserving not only lifestyle, but also kind of like a little park someplace. And a part of the reason why monastics like living in there's a variety of reasons why they like living in contact with nature. One certainly is the serenity that can be there, the peace. It's very nourishing, as so many of you know. And here's an ancient poem, song, that goes back to almost the time of the Buddha. I have a monk who composed. Alone and in the woods, with no one else around, life becomes exquisite. Off I go then to lead the forest life the Buddha praised. I will taste the welfare that he knows, he who dwells alone and concentrated. Quickly and alone, intent on my welfare, I will go to the woods that I love, to the haunt of elephants, to the source of a yogi's joy. In the flowery glades of cool woods, I will roam in ample solitude. And when hot and tired, I will bathe in refreshing pools, in the hollows of the hills. I will fasten my mind's armor, enter the woods, and not come out, until I have destroyed what poisons my heart. I will sit on a mountaintop, and while the wind blows cool and fragrant across my forehead, I will burst the mists of ignorance. Then on the carpet of flowers, in that wood and in the cool cliff caves, and blessed with the joy of freedom, I will take my ease. A beautiful, poem. And so it's one of the reasons why nature is often emphasized as a place to practice is it's uplifting. It's inspiring. It also is a place of, it tends to be very tranquil, hence it tends to produce tranquility and peace. I think also it teaches us something very powerful about ourselves and our relationship to the world and our relationship to ourselves. To me, it's meaningful that when the Buddha was going to teach his son, his teachings on not-self. Not-self is a very challenging teaching in Buddhism. And it can seem kind of dry and philosophical, and there's no true essential soul, there's no self. And then it's philosophically explained. It can seem very dry and philosophical and unrelated to, life as many of us live. But when the Buddha was going to teach his own son that teaching, he took him deep into the woods, in a place where there was the equivalent of the California redwood groves. Big redwood groves, the sala trees, beautiful majestic trees. And in this grove of these big trees, in nature, your understanding of who you are and your is very different than if you're kind of in the busy city. And our sense of kind of being part of something bigger, connected to something beautiful, maybe even sacred. And to be told there's not any self in the midst of this wonderful interconnected world in nature, it has a very different meaning than if you're sitting, in Market Street in San Francisco and someone says there's no self. At least I think. it's just kind of more inspiring in that kind of setting. One of the, I went to college and graduate school. And in college, I studied agronomy, the art and science of field crop management. And in graduate school, I studied religious studies, the art and science of what? So I took a lot of religious studies classes in graduate school, and I took a lot of science and botany, environmental studies, and different classes in undergraduate school. And the most religious classes I took, the most spiritual classes I took, were my botany classes, not my religious studies classes. And I remember taking an introduction to botany and being told, it makes a beautiful diagram on the chalkboard of the cycles of, oxygen cycles and CO2 cycles and how it all works and plants and all that. And kind of taking it all in and then leaving the classroom at UC Davis out into the courtyard with all these beautiful trees and standing there kind of in awe. Because I stood there just still for a long time looking at the trees. And the sense of that awe was, where do I end and where do the trees begin? And I had this sense that, I could do away with an arm, I could do away with an eye, with both eyes, I could do away with my kidneys. There's a lot of things that I think are pretty important about who I am. I could actually survive quite well without. But I can't survive, very long at all without the plants out there. And if I depend on them more than I depend on my kidney, or my thyroid, or my eye, or something, where do I stop? Where's my boundaries of my body, who I am? And at that time I felt this tremendous sense of interconnectedness and stillness and awe in that relationship to the natural world. So, you know, and so you find in the forest traditions of Buddhism an emphasis that the forest also teaches us. Nature is a teacher for us. And it teaches us a variety of things. It teaches us impermanence. It teaches us the interconnectedness of things. It teaches us stillness. It teaches us a little bit about our social construct of who we think we are. It really sometimes stands in stark contrast. Like, for example, if you're a person who likes to have status and you go into the woods, you take your status with you, it's kind of hard. You know. Or you're somebody who kind of wants to prove how wonderful they are by the size of your car. You know. So, you know, it doesn't work so well there. So the forest is a place that teaches us. But we don't want to be idealistic also about the forest. While living in the forest, this is a modern contemporary Thai forest monk who writes, while living in the forest may sound quite idyllic from a romantic standpoint, on a practical front, a number of difficulties exist. The hour-long climb up the mountain after the meal is always a hot and sweaty affair. Perhaps the most incessant challenges come from the impressive array of insects and creepy crawlies that have to be reckoned with. Ticks, biting horseflies, bees, termites, ants, mosquitoes, spiders, snakes, scorpions, rats, and centipedes. Blood-sucking leeches, albeit harmless creatures, also cause quite a mess of blood. It requires a constant effort to keep my few possessions dry from the rain and keep from the creatures that climb onto my free from the creatures that climb onto my platform. The nights are cold and damp. When I awaken in the night, I often get the sense that I am open prey for any large flesh-eating creature. It is not uncommon in the middle of the night to hear footsteps of animals, or even to hear the breathing of some confused animal, such as a bear or a wild boar, next to my platform, seemingly trying to determine what it has bumped into. Invariably, these animals smell who I am and leave me alone. On more rare occasions, monks have come across deer being attacked by wild dogs, or a panther. Other monks have seen tigers while doing walking meditation. Some even have reported running into wild rhinoceroses. One recent night, a monk walked down the path from his platform to investigate a curious sound of bamboo being munched upon, only to his astonishment to find a herd of wild elephants. The earth shook, rumbling as if there were a small earthquake, as the elephants fled in surprise. Most people, when they go out into the wilderness, go out with physical weapons to protect themselves. But when a monk goes out, then there's nothing. No weapons. Your only weapon is your state of mind. That is your major tool. So that's interesting. Again, you know, how do you engage? How do you live in this world, in the wild, in nature, in a way that's safe? And how do you take care of it? So it's not idyllic. It's a tremendous challenge. And so, not only is it inspiring, but also it creates a lot of inner strength and a lot of inner self-understanding to deal with our fear. We have to kind of rise to the occasion and cultivate the qualities that make us not kind of run away, sit there. There's lots of stories and of monks sitting there in meditation late at night and having some kind of tiger growl nearby, or walk around them, smelling. So, you know, you should get up and run. That usually doesn't work so well when tigers are near you. And so, what's the best strategy? Don't go in the woods. Don't be a monastic. Lock yourself up, you know, in the city. That's possible. And or what does it take? You know, and so at least some people have been inspired by that kind of life, and have cultivated what it takes to face those kinds of challenges. So if you only think of it as being, you know, idyllic, that's not very realistic. There's also challenges in that kind of life. And that's part of the value that it has. Sometimes I feel a little bit sad that so many people practice in places like Spirit Rock. The inspiration about Spirit Rock, which is a retreat center we have in Marin County, is this really beautiful nature place. And it's designed, the whole place is designed so you cannot stay indoors all the time. You're in fort. You have to go outside. And I love it there. No matter what the weather is there, I love it because somehow you're so connected with the elements there. It's windy, rainy, stormy, sunny, hot, whatever. Just your part, and you're always going out into these Marin oak hills, hillsides, and being part of it. It's great. On the other hand, and there are mountain lions there, and rattlesnakes, and ticks, and other things that are make it occasional challenge. But mostly, it's very comfortable there. And the advantage of practicing in a comfortable place, it's easier to relax, let go, settle down, get calm and peaceful and all that. So it's great. The disadvantage is that you're not challenged with discomfort. And sometimes Buddhism actually thrives better when there's also challenges in the practice. Now, some people won't go and practice if it's too challenging. So we have, you know, this remedial place where we kind of get people settled. But then sooner or later, I think it's good to practice in Buddhism in a setting where your mental state, your mind, is actually challenged as well. So it's not just comfortable, the situation you're practicing in. So this place, the Buddha, the image of the Buddha, and I think, you know, for me at least, when I think of the image, the symbol of the Buddha, sitting on the ground under a tree, I also see it as a place that mediates, heaven and earth. It mediates the place of the ideal and mediates the place of the ground, the earth itself. And this mediation between our inner life, the ecology of our mind, and the outer life, the ecology of nature and the world. What is the interface? What's the meeting place of a human and nature? What's the influence? What's the impact of the two? Recently, I was in Arizona, and we were out in the desert between Phoenix and Tucson at the national park there. And I found out that when the park was started, Casa Grande National Park, some 60 years ago, the area was forested. It wasn't like really dense forest like we're familiar with here, but it was forested, kind of desert area. And now there was very, very few trees left, very open. And the reason for that, I was told, was Phoenix nearby. And it used to be that the groundwater was only a few feet below the surface of the ground. And as Phoenix is a thirsty city, they've gone into the groundwater to get the water. And so the groundwater has dropped and dropped and dropped. And finally, there's no groundwater at all. And now Phoenix, in order to get more water for a growing city, it has to go down some, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet. Someone from Phoenix know how far it is? Anyways, really far. They have to drill and drill and drill to find more of these aquifers down there. So as the groundwater went away, there's no groundwater there to support the vegetation. And so not only is there a lot less vegetation there, but also it's gotten hotter. It used to be a lot cooler back when there was more water in the ground and more vegetation. And that kind of impact humans have on nature is repeated, a million times, 100-fold times all over the world. Not a modern phenomenon. I grew up partly when I was young on the Adriatic coast in a small city called Trieste, right next to the Yugoslavian coast. And we would go down, sometimes drive down on weekend or something down the Adriatic coast in Yugoslavia, back in the Yugoslavia days, and the islands there. And it was deforested 2,000 years ago in order to grow olives for the Romans. And now what's left is rock. All the soil was washed away. And so there's no, once the soil was gone, it'll take maybe, a few tens of thousands of years to build it up again. And so it's beautiful, it's quite beautiful, but it's also, you know, we realize that it used to be forested. And this kind of example, of humans impacting their environment has gone on for thousands of years in big, big, big ways. The difference now is that how it's not so at a global scale. It's a whole different thing. And then go back, realizing the global impact humans have, we can go back to the interesting myths of that Buddhism has, that supposedly were taught by the Buddha, the myths of the Genesis, of the origin of life as we have it now. And these myths that describe the relationship between human greed and the state of our world, the nature of the world. And these myths say there's a very intimate or close relationship between human greed and the state of the world. It used to be that the world was a really idyllic, peaceful, wonderful place. And then people started getting greedy. And as they got greedy, things got harder and the world became a more difficult place. And step by step by step, things got more and more difficult. It's a myth. But it's a myth of the impact of greed and how it affects not only the whole environment, the world that as we know it. And it used to be that it was really easy to get food. It's just like you can go out and pick food from just pick it from the local trees and plants just there available to have. But as people got greedy and started hoarding the food, because they didn't want to go out every day and go searching for it, started hoarding it, well then the plants didn't just appear easily to get food. They had to start planting the food. And then when they started planting the food, then they started making, claiming land for themselves, private property. And as private property started to happen, then lifetime started to decrease. And then, as they started making private property, then nature started to change in relationship to that. And so, I'm not describing it very well, but there's this, in the myth, there's an intimate connection between human greed and the nature we have. Now, 300 years ago, maybe it just seems kind of idealistic or fantasy-like, these kinds of myths. But now we see, it's obvious that human consumption, human greed, has a huge impact at a global level, this world we live in. And they say they're right here in the Bay Area, right? That now they have to start planning for the sea level going up, because much of the bay is so shallow. So now they have to, pretty soon we have this beautiful Blair Island nearby. And some of you go hiking on Blair Island. It's kind of nice out there. 20 years, 50 years, probably all underwater. So the impact of the mind on nature is uncontestable. So Buddhist practice then has a lot to do with the human mind. And as we care for our human mind, the idea is that then indirectly or directly, we also take care of our planet and our earth. If we don't somehow come to terms or look honestly at the forces of consumption, of greed, of hate, of our disconnect with nature and the impact our lives have on nature, then I don't think there's much hope for this planet of ours. And it's so easy to put on blinders. It's so easy to live, very simply be caught up in the details of our life, the suffering, the challenges of our life, and assume that the life we have, the lifestyle we have, is to be taken for granted. We deserve it. I once was many years ago went to try out a new car, I think it was a Honda place here. Tried a little Honda Civic or something. And I was driving around and I wasn't interested in getting an air conditioner. It seemed like too much. I was driving around and the salesman was driving it with me and he turned to me and said, "Well, you deserve an air conditioner." I didn't get the logic of that. What's the logic of that? I deserve it? What did I do? But we have that kind of logic in our society. You deserve, we have a right to certain kinds of things. And, kind of built into much of human, you know, Western or American psyche, it seems to me. And so do we question it? And I think that the only way to question it that is realistic for us is if we have a sense of something better. And so rather than thinking that it's a moral, puritanical obligation to simplify our life and, you know, stop destroying the planet, which I almost think we do have that obligation. But rather, you know, that Buddhism offers, rather than obligation, it offers us certainly a sense of connection, understanding of the impact, understanding of the relationship. But it offers us an alternative that is meant to be really satisfying, really fulfilling. And the example of the Buddha sitting under the tree in this peaceful, happy kind of state is not meant to be an experience of deprivation. It's not meant to be renouncing all the pleasure and joy and delight of life and live an impoverished life. It's meant to be a life where you discover a much richer form of happiness, much richer form of joy and delight and peace than you can ever get from watching Dexter on television. Which I haven't ever watched. But when a friend of mine was describing to me the premise of this television show, I was kind of confused. You know, and why would I want to sit there and watch that when I could meditate? And so I don't know how we convey to people, myself as a teacher, or to, you know, our center as maybe a model of Buddhist practice, the how fulfilling and happy producing it is to have nothing. You know, maybe, you know, when IMC has enough surplus money, I'll talk to Claudine about this, our treasurer. We have enough surplus money. Maybe, what do you think about having a big bulletin board? I buy a bulletin board space, billboard space on 101. And it says something like, you know, you can be happy with nothing. Don't buy. Well, those kinds of advertisements don't generate a lot of money. But how to convey that in a visceral, meaningful way, you know, that you can really be happy? And what are the challenges we have in our own minds when we have all these messages and ideas of what we need in order to be safe, what we need in order to be happy, that maybe really go counter to the very kind of nature, the ecology of the heart, where the heart knows how to be happy in some very deep, deep way, without consuming, without getting, without protecting, just in its beingness, the natural beingness. One of the most meaningful things that my Zen teacher told me was, he turned to me once. I was describing what was going on with my life, and I was driving. He was driving me back. He was driving me across, Mel Weitzman was driving me his little Volkswagen Bug back then that he took care of himself. And I was a new Zen student, and he asked me about myself. I was telling him what I was doing with my life that time. And when I finished telling him my life, he turned to me, going across the Bay Bridge. He turned to me, he's driving, he turned to me and he said, "Gil," he said, "just to be alive is enough." And that kind of, that really got me. And many, many years later, 20, 30 years later, I found out that his teacher had turned to him and said that to him. So it's a wonderful lineage. Just to be alive is enough. And to be alive is also to feel this interconnectedness where our lives is the meeting of the full moon and the earth. And if we feel that meeting, and we have nothing to lose but to offer our support to help save this planet of ours. I think hopefully it's an expression of the full moon. It's an expression of our awakened nature. It's an expression of being completely at peace and happy and content here in this heart, that it's really natural for that to then to be acted on and trying to make a difference to make this place that we all live in, share, a place that's beautiful and safe and healthy and supportive of all of us. So we can have life as mutual supportive event. May that be the case. May the Earth Day remind us of that. So thank you so much. Mm-hmm.